This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is the New York Times Magazine for Sunday, the 14th of April. I'm Dave Abbott. This week, I'll start by finishing the article I started last week, What I Saw Working at the National Enquirer During Donald Trump's Rise, inside the notorious catch-and-kill campaign that now stands at the heart of the former president's legal trial, this by Lachlan Cartwright. And you'll recall last week we were addressing the stories about Ted Cruz and his father, and that the author was moved into a better office with windows, and he got the safe that the contract relating to the Trump Tower doorman and his story about a Trump love child that contract was in the safe, and other boxes of material collected on the Clintons. So, back to the article, I was going through the memos from the freelancer that had provided the basis for spurious stories accusing Hillary Clinton of forming a hit squad to kill Vince Foster. And then we moved on to hyperbolic material on Bill Clinton and women, Hillary's hiding Bill's sex crimes, 36 women break their silence, was the cover that landed May 2016. Between those were a drumbeat of fictitious health crises for the former First Lady and then presidential candidate, with the help of so-called medical experts, typically publicity-hungry pundits who understood what we wanted to hear, and the assistance of a talented art department, we tried to kill her off in print almost weekly. She would appear with her eyes made baggy and the colors in the images desaturated. In others, she swelled to fit the cover line that she had gained 103 pounds and was eating herself to death. In another, we purported to have her full medical file, which, as the cover screamed, she said she had 3 strokes, Alzheimer's, liver damage from booze, and violent rages. And we had another secret weapon, Michael Silvestri. By day, Silvestri worked at the Walt Disney Company, but at night he operated Truth and Deception Technologies in Florida. We would send Silvestri audio clips of politicians or celebrities speaking, and after using software that he called Deceptech, voice stress analysis, he sent back charts at $500 a test. Hillary failed secret FBI lie detector was one such cover. We had no reason to believe Deceptech had ever been used by the FBI. We went to him so often that I could signal that we required his services again by using a cranking hand motion. In August, Howard told me that he had met with a former Playboy playmate named Karen McDougal, who said she had an affair with Trump. The woman was being represented by a lawyer, Keith Davidson, and Howard said he found her story credible. Howard told me that Pecker bought her story for $150,000, but that it would never see the light of day. It was the second catch and kill on Trump's behalf that I'd heard about. I started to avoid Howard as best I could. Our interactions became icy, and colleagues in the newsroom started to notice. I felt as if I were being suffocated, and I feared that being near all of this would mean the end of my career. Late in the afternoon, on the Friday before the 2016 election, I received a call from Lucas Alpert, a Wall Street Journal reporter. He and I used to work together at the New York Post, and we kept in touch. He was on the media desk now, but explained that he had been asked by a colleague on the investigative team for help on a story. Did I know anything about a woman named Karen McDougal? I froze. I was in the newsroom, only feet from Howard. I told Alpert I would call him back. I walked to the elevator and rode it down to the entrance of the building. I explained the huge risk I was taking by helping him and the consequences if Pecker or Howard found out. I thought if I used an old school tabloid term, it would give me some cover. Only the guys who had been there forever used that term. This was a catch and kill, I told Albert. What's a catch and kill? He asked. I went on to explain the tabloid practice of buying stories to bury them. Albert already had the outline of the story, I learned, and I filled him in on more. How Howard had flown out to Los Angeles that summer to buy McDougal's story for $150,000 with the direction from Pecker to kill it to protect Trump. I stressed to him the importance of the term catch and kill and told him that if the journal included it, it would give me some breathing room. I went back to my office and closed the door. My heart was racing and I was sweating. A short time later, Howard burst in. The Wall Street Journal has a story coming, I recall him saying, before naming two former employees, blaming them for the leak. He slammed the door shut. The story went live after 9 that night. National Enquirer shielded Donald Trump from Playboy model's affair allegation. And there it was, in the third paragraph. Quashing stories that way is known in the tabloid world as catch and kill. I didn't hear from Howard that weekend. No one thought Trump was going to win at that point, and the story was swallowed up in the pre-election frenzy. That same week, I had finally hit my breaking point with the job. A few days earlier, Howard called me into his office. He explained that we would be crashing a late exclusive. He had obtained a 7-page dossier that contained what he said were emails between Hillary Clinton and Huma Abedin, one of her longtime aides. The only snag was that the emails were in Italian, and we had just hours to get them translated if we wanted any chance of meeting our print deadlines. Howard told me that Pecker had spent thousands of dollars to buy the file from a private investigator. Pecker was always paranoid about leaks and had paid this investigator's firm to do sweeps of AMI's office looking for listening devices, and now the investigator had become a source. From the editor, in response to questions from the Times, the investigator said he could not remember many details of this episode. Back to the story. The dossier, Howard explained, had come to our source via the Agenzia Informazione e Sicurezza Esterna, Italian intelligence, where the source apparently had connections. This is why the emails, though originally written in English, were in Italian. The agency had received the emails from Russia's former Foreign Intelligence Service, the source said, which had itself hacked Clinton's servers and obtained the emails from a laptop Abedin shared with her estranged husband, Anthony Weiner. Despite the many red flags and ethical questions that chain of custody raised, Howard believed in the dossier, and besides, Pecker had already decreed that this would be the cover story. The research team had found 2 New York University students to translate the documents. When they arrived, I was instructed to confiscate their cell phones. The translators finished, and we managed to close the issue by midnight. Hillary and Huma going to jail was the cover line, with bullet points claiming, among other things, a secret hospitalization and truth about gay affair. The translations in the article were totally garbled, and the inferences we made from them were absurd. While it made its way to the printers, I went with Howard and some colleagues to White Horse Tavern, not the famous one, the one in the financial district. He was buzzing with glee. I could barely look him in the eye. I needed to get out, but I needed my visa to stay in the country and find another job. I held on to the thought that this would all soon be over. The election was just 6 days away. Clinton looked sure to win. Trump would fade away. I would be able to find my way out. and back to actual journalism. Instead, my duties somehow became even more depraved when the Wall Street Journal contacted AMI for comment about the $150,000 payment to Karen McDougal. The company claimed that the money was not to kill her story, but rather to purchase her life rights to any relationship she has had with a then-married man, as well as 2 years of fitness columns and magazine covers. This had, in fact, been stipulated in the contract AMI drew up with her lawyer, but now we had to actually come up with the columns. I assigned a reporter to ghostwrite them, and he got on a call with McDougal to take notes while cribbing fitness tips from the internet. Albert and his colleagues at the Journal were chasing fresh leads. I mentioned the doorman and the events of the previous year. Albert asked for the names, so I opened the safe and got out the contract, which contained notes from the names of the woman and the love adult. I texted them to Albert, put the documents back, and went to close the safe, but the door wouldn't shut. I tried desperately, but this rickety old safe refused to close. I was starting to panic. At any time, Howard could come in. I turned up the sound on my office TV as I sat hammering at this old metal door. Finally, the bloody thing shut. After Trump won, I could not hide my utter contempt for Howard. My position as his deputy became untenable. By this point, the two of us were barely on speaking terms. I wasted my afternoons drinking alone in nearby bars and restaurants while I devised an exit strategy. I retained an employment attorney, knowing that both Howard and Pecker would love nothing more than to screw me on the way out. Howard was enraged by my behavior and made it known to others in the newsroom. In July 2017, after weeks of negotiations, I was presented with a 9-page separation agreement. I would be kept on as an employee for the next 9 months, collecting half my salary as a form of severance. That meant I would be able to continue living in the U.S. until my visa expired, but the price would be my silence. A non-disclosure agreement covering AMI in general, and Pecker in particular. The contract's language was so broad that it prohibited me in perpetuity from even writing a work of fiction about my time at the company. On August 4th, I entered the morning news meeting for the final time. Howard announced to the staff I would be working from home for the foreseeable future. I looked him in the eye and shook his hand. It would be the last time I saw him. About 6 weeks after I left, and around the time the New York Times and the New Yorker broke the Weinstein story, I was walking back to my apartment when I got a call from my attorney. AMI's lawyers had sent him a letter accusing me of breaching my non-disclosure agreement on 3 occasions. The letter threatened termination and damages, but it was the next sentence that got me. In the event AMI terminates Mr. Cartwright's employment, he will not be entitled to lawfully remain in the USA. I vomited. They might not have known what I'd actually done, but it seemed they were trying to scare me into silence. I resolved that if I was approached by a journalist whom I trusted and who I knew would protect me, I would do my best to help. Someone out there could do the work I should have been doing all along. A few weeks later, I received a direct message on Twitter from a New York Times reporter. I responded to him with my cell number and agreed to meet. I told the reporter what happened in 2015 with Gutierrez. I detailed Howard's requests for damaging information on women connected to Weinstein, which usually followed their regular Tribeca lunches. Howard says he never asked Inquirer staffers to share damaging information on women connected to Weinstein. But I stressed that the real story was the Inquirer's work on behalf of Trump. eventually I got a burner phone, as I was in almost daily contact with the reporter at the Times, my contact at the Journal, and others. It was hard to keep them all straight. I emailed the New Yorker writer, Ronan Farrow, with the subject line, "Signal." "Are you on it?" I asked. He was in touch an hour later, and I began telling him what happened with Dino the doorman. It became clear to me that reporters from the Journal were in possession of information that could have come from only a small circle of people, and I feared that the source was Howard. If the reporters I had been talking to were incautious, they could have easily revealed to him that I had been a source, too. It would be the ammunition Howard needed to terminate my agreement and have me booted from the country. But on the other hand, if he was a source, how could he tell Pecker that he had learned I was, too? These paranoid thoughts kept me up at night. I had heard AMI sometimes tailed current and former employees. I became convinced that the same was happening to me. That might explain an incident that took place one evening when I went to Babeland, an adult store in Soho, and walked out with a dildo, lubricant, and condoms. As I exited the store, a car pulled up, and out jumped a man with a camera who proceeded in the most indiscreet way to take a series of photos of me with a bright flash. Before I knew it, he jumped back in the car, and it sped off. Were those photos going to be used to embarrass me? Was it a way to scare me? With just weeks left on my visa, I'd spent 6 months working free as a source, a self-imposed sentence for my many crimes against journalism. By this time, I was in the late stages of interviews for a new job with the Daily Beast and an opportunity to resuscitate my byline. Since I had left AMI, I have lived under constant threat of litigation from my former employer. AMI has threatened me with a $5 million lawsuit for breach of contract. In 2020, AMI was merged with another company and renamed A360 Media. A360 Media did not respond to requests for comment. Howard has threatened me with another $5 million suit over articles I wrote for the Daily Beast, accusing me of defamation and breach of contract. But now the facts of what happened are a matter of public record. The basis for the first ever criminal trial of a former president. Indeed, Packer and Howard have already testified before Bragg's grand jury. If they are called again to testify at trial, they will in all likelihood be revealing some of the same information they tried to intimidate me into withholding. As I have tried to come to terms with just how corrupt an organization I worked for in those years, I have taken some comfort in the fact that acting as a source for other journalists helped rebalance the scales, not only for me, but for the public, too. After the last legal threat Howard sent me in October of 2020, a lawyer representing me wrote a strongly worded letter in response, arguing that the information I shared was in the public interest and in some cases was of profound national importance. The letters stopped. No suits have been filed. 3 years after leaving the building for the last time, I finally felt free of the place. And then the Bragg indictment outlined in plain and unafraid black and white the schemes that felt so opaque and contentious and complex when I had to navigate my way through them in real time. But it was the 13-page statement of facts that brought me to tears. On page 3, prosecutors outlined the catch-and-kill scheme to suppress negative information, and it revealed to me that I had been managing a newsroom with improvised explosive devices planted everywhere. The secret deal that was made at Trump Tower, where Pecker told Cohen he would act as the campaign's eyes and ears, the hush money payoffs, the plot to publish negative stories about Trump's rivals, a scheme to influence the 2016 election. Everything finally fit into place. There were no more secrets. and I wasn't alone anymore. Everyone now knew. Next up, the case against good coffee. Instant coffee tastes just okay. And that's fine by me, by Peter C. Baker. Not long ago, I went through a long period during which I awoke every morning with absolutely no desire to make coffee. Don't misunderstand, I still wanted to drink the stuff. With a 3-year-old and 1-year-old waking me up around, if I was lucky, 6 in the morning, I relied on coffee sharpening effect more than ever. I was just tired of working for it. Picking which beans to use that day. I was always buying beans. Grinding them, placing the grounds in the filter, wiping up the grounds that spilled on the counter, measuring out the water. Waiting. Not long ago, I loved the ritual of it all. Together, the steps were part of the machinery I employed to coax myself into consciousness and face the day. But now, I didn't want to be coaxed. I wanted to be woken up as fast as possible so I could tend to my kids. The routine had, at some point, devolved into yet another chore, especially once I started forgetting to empty the filter when I was done, leaving as a gift for my future self an unpleasant deposit of sodden grounds. One day in the grocery store, I found a solution staring me in the face in the form of a surprisingly large array of instant coffee options. Experience had taught me that it tasted horrible. In my 20s, I worked abroad at a newspaper staffed largely by expat British journalists who drank Nescafe as if it were water. I wondered what, historically, culturally, could explain this. Maybe the Blitz? Nescafe tasted to me like something formulated in a malicious lab experiment involving dust and cinders, and few, if any, coffee beans. It didn't help that the dehydrated crystals resembled the droppings of a small disease-carrying rodent. The instant coffees I encountered more recently on the grocery store shelf looked exactly the same, albeit in some instances in slicker packaging adorned with stylish labels. Maybe, I told myself, instant had improved. The next morning, up again with the kids, I spooned a heaping tablespoon of instant coffee crystals into a mug, poured in the hot water, and that was it. Process done. The coffee was fine. Not as good as a cup of freshly roasted single origin shade grown made at my favorite shop, but it was recognizably coffee. There was no process worth speaking of to enjoy, but there were no grounds on the counter either, and I soon felt the caffeine caressing my synapses. If I had to pick one word to describe the process, that word would be instant. And if I had to pick one word to describe how this simplified process made me feel, that word would be good. Instant coffee reminded me why I started on coffee as a college student. I didn't bring coffee into my life because I especially liked the taste of it or appreciated the distinction between different roasting methods or bean types. I was aware, mostly from the examples of classmates and the movies, that it could magically reconfigure my energies, creating pockets of alertness where they otherwise might not have existed. Life then felt like an adventure I could arrange as I saw fit, and coffee was a tool that helped me do that. Once, coffee kept me awake so I could pick up a love interest at the airport at midnight. In my car, I felt like the hero of a fantasy story slipping beneath the surface of the sleeping world to find another realm underneath. one where people were still in motion, still working and playing and chasing after what they wanted, long after polite society had gone to sleep. Afterward, we went to a diner we liked. It was the same as always, but felt completely new. All the familiar details, the grilled cheese, the mustard, were little notes stitched into a broader symphony of wonder and surprise. Over time, coffee became less of a novel superpower and more of a familiar default, something I counted on and rarely took the time to be amazed or even especially delighted by. You would be forgiven for thinking otherwise, looking at my receipts for beans over the years, or assessing the arsenal of coffee tools I had acquired, all the grinders and filters and special little scoops, the multiple French presses, the mocha pot I bought in grad school and can't find anymore, the workhorse drip machine that remains the best way to make coffee for a group. Yes, these tools sometimes produced coffee that tasted good. Yes, they became familiar, comforting parts of my morning, but my experiments and purchases were motivated less by an innate lust for superior coffee and more by a vague sense, absorbed osmotically from my cultural milieu, that better coffee was something adults strive for. Instant coffee renewed my appreciation for the alchemical powers that drew me to coffee in the first place. The previous night's dishes were still piled in the sink and on the counter. My son was using maple syrup to trace an indecipherable design on the kitchen table. My daughter's Cheerios were on the floor, and she had a look on her face that made clear that she would soon need a new diaper. The scene wasn't anyone's idea of a soothing wake-up ritual, but coffee helped me hear that beautiful music of wonder and surprise. Old habits, coffee-related and otherwise, are gathering dust in the cabinets of my life, but in the space created by their absence, new life comes streaming in. More of it every instant. Next and last, Judge John Hodgman on getting angry at someone for things they did in a dream. Stephanie writes, "Sometimes my husband wakes up angry at me for something I did in his dream. He feels he is justified because whatever happened in his dream is something I would have done. I say this is not fair." Judge John Hodgman responds, "I hate to say it, but you do seem like a person who would do something mean to your husband in his dreams while riding a sandworm from Dune. Except suddenly it's not Dune anymore. It's me watching the red balloon in my high school French class. Weird, because there's virtually no dialogue in that movie except when the balloon tells me my mouth is full of crickets. Wait, no, that's not real. That's just the dream I had last night. Probably. I'm sorry. I forgot that dreams are just stories my brain writes for itself, and they're dumb, junk narratives made of half-memory and fear that mean nothing and are definitely not your fault. I'll have to remind your husband when I see him tonight in the form of Gene Hackman, except with a third eye on his forehead and cheese for teeth." Ew. Well, that's all my time for today. This is Dave Abbott. This has been the New York Times Magazine. Thanks so much for listening, and let's be careful out there.